Revelations chapter 12. A great and wondrous sign appeared in heaven. A woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and a crown of 12 stars on her head. She was pregnant and cried out in pain as she was about to give birth. Then another sign appeared in heaven, an enormous red dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 crowns on his head. His tail swept a third of the stars out of the sky and flung them to the earth. The dragon stood in front of the woman who was about to give birth, so that he might devour her child the moment it was born. She gave birth to a son, a male child, who will rule all the nations with an iron scepter. And her child was snatched up to God and to his throne. The woman fled into the desert to a place prepared for her by God, where she might be taken care of for 1,260 days. And there was war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon and his angels fought back. But he was not strong enough, and they lost their place in heaven. The great dragon was hurled down, that ancient serpent called the devil or Satan, who leads the whole world astray. He was hurled to the earth and his angels with him. Then I heard a loud voice in heaven say, "Now have come the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ. For the accuser of our brothers, who accuses them before our God day and night, has been hurled down. They overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony. They did not love their lives so much as to shrink from death. Therefore rejoice, you heavens, and you who dwell in them. But woe to the earth and the sea, because the devil has gone down to you. He is filled with fury because he knows that his time is short." When the dragon saw that he had been hurled to the earth, he pursued the woman who had given birth to the male child. The woman was given the 2 wings of a great eagle so that she might fly to the place prepared for her in the desert, where she would be taken care of for a time, times, and half a time out of the serpent's reach. Then from his mouth the serpent spewed water like a river, to overtake the woman and sweep her away with the torrent. But the earth helped the woman by opening its mouth and swallowing the river that the dragon had spewed out of his mouth. Then the dragon was enraged at the woman and went off to make war against the rest of her offspring, those who obey God's commandments and hold to the testimony of Jesus. And the dragon stood on the shore of the sea.
If you'd like to turn back to page 1241 and Revelation 12, 13 and 14, we're going to look at. And I've done this the last few talks really, is start with a question. And the question for this evening is being a Christian, do you think, is being a Christian about security or safety? Do you think it's about a battle and a fight, or about security and safety? Battle and fight, or security and safety? Now, you could go to Bible verses and find both, couldn't you? So I could go through some Bible verses and say, there you go, it's all about being safe in God's hands. Or I could take you to some Bible verses and show it's all about a big battle that we face. And you've probably heard me do sermons about the first and others about the second and some about both. So which is it all about? Been thinking about soldiers today. If you're a soldier in Iraq or Afghanistan, you know you're in a battle. There's no safe place to be doing a job like that. When you sit in front of TV, it's a bit of a different different situation. You just sit there and it's nice and you're warm and you watch TV. Well, which is being a Christian most like, being in a battle or TV watching? And the answer to that is strangely both. We are in a battle which could cost us all that we have, yet we fight from a position of absolute safety knowing the end result. And how can both be true? Well, what we've said as we've gone through, the way the book of Revelation works, this is like a peeling back. So there's history presents itself to us one way, and what Revelation does is sort of peel back the curtain so we see what's happening backstage. We see the whole picture. We see the whole of history from God's perspective. We see into heaven from God's perspective. And chapters 12 to 14 show us how if we trust Christ, we are eternally secure and yet also engage in a battle. There are three things we're going to look at. The first is chapter 12, that the future is assured. Second, Satan's fury about this future in chapter 13. And third is the future of the church. So first is chapter 12, the future is assured. In chapter 12, we're taught that the future is secure, but there is a battle. The battle is in heaven between Christ and his angels and against Satan and his angels. But this battle, Christ has already won. It's odd, isn't it? Normally you fight a battle in order to have an outcome. But actually, this battle is fought after there is an outcome. And the consequences of this battle is seen on earth. So what we have is verses 1 to 6, if you look at chapter 12, verses 1 to 6 is a summary, and 7 to 17 is the detail, and expanded slightly. So verses 1 to 6, there's a pregnant woman gives birth to a child, and a dragon waits to consume him, the child. But God takes him to heaven to his throne, and then the woman is then protected by God in the desert. That's chapter 12. Straightforward, isn't it? Who is this, and when is this? Who's the woman? Well, Roman Catholics would generally argue that this is Mary giving birth to Jesus. I don't think it is, and there's some reasons for that. It'd be a bit random to just bring Mary in at this point, because the book so far we've seen, and we'll go on to see, is all about the church. Revelation is a book about the church. Also, there's nothing here that refers to real events in her life, other than she gave birth to a child that finishes up going to heaven. But there's nothing here about her being taken off and about her being attacked directly by Satan. So what's going on here? Well, remember which book we're in, and the way John writes is we have more symbols, more picture language. So it mentions here about the sun, the moon, and the 12 stars. Well, this isn't the first time they're mentioned in the Bible. They're mentioned in Joseph's dreams. The sun refers to Jacob, the moon to Joseph's mum, and the 12 stars to the 12 tribes. And of course, we've already had 12 stars in Revelation, haven't we? They're about the angels of the church. This woman then represents Israel. Israel gives birth to a male child who will rule the nations. I think we know who that is, don't we? That's talking about Jesus, who is the representative of all Israel. So what all Israel is there for. The dragon, we're told in verse 9, is the serpent from Genesis 3. He's the devil. And so here we see Satan's aim is the destruction of Jesus. At first, he is a dragon with 7 heads, 10 horns, 7 crowns, and he's red. And we thought before that red is a symbolic colour. It symbolises strife. And he has power and authority on the earth. In verse 4, his tail brings down a third of the stars. In chapter 1, we saw the stars are the angels. So this refers to the idea that Satan brings down a third of the angels with him. It's a reference elsewhere, fallen angels at work with Satan. But God's people are protected in the desert by God. They're protected and fed by him. In fact, for 1,260 days. We won't get worried too much about all these numbers, but the idea is it's for a limited time. So that's the summary in verses 1 to 6. 7 to 17 is the detail. And we'll just pick up a few things. 7 to 9, there's a battle in heaven. The angels led by Michael fight the devil and his angels. And there's a reference to this sort of thing in the book of Daniel. Michael is delayed getting to Daniel because he's in this spiritual battle. And all this stuff in Daniel is related to the political battles of his day. Here Michael wins and Satan is thrown to the earth. Now that's odd, really. We have to start reshaping our thinking about heaven, don't we? Because in the Old Testament, where do you find the devil? In heaven, talking to God. But now he's defeated and he's cast down. And in verses 10 to 12... victory is announced, Satan is defeated, and look at how and by whom. Verse 11, they, Christians, by Christ's blood and testimony. So the accuser, that's his name in verse 10, is beaten by Christ's blood. Christ's blood defeats him because it removes the accusation. So Satan can't, once he can't accuse, he has no power. So our sin deserves punishment, but Jesus died in our place. That means there is no punishment if we believe in him. It's as if we've never sinned. So what can Satan accuse you with? His power's gone. He's defeated by a Christian's testimony, which is why we keep on going and we keep on telling. In verses 13 to 17, Satan is furious about this and he attacks the woman, the people of God, Israel. Then he attacks her children, that is us by faith, the church. And so in verse 17 of chapter 12, then the dragon was enraged at the woman and went off to make war against the rest of her offspring, those who obey God's commandments and hold to the testimony of Jesus. It makes sense of the promises and security and warnings. Satan is defeated. The victory is seen at the cross. He's disarmed. He can't win. Jesus has won. He's not just odds-on favourite. He has won. Therefore, we're safe and there's nothing to fear. There's no power in the universe, not even supernatural powers, that can remove us from God. But Satan, although defeated, still exists and he's active and he's furious and he aims to destroy the church. He can't as such, ultimately, but he still aims to make us miserable and ineffective. So if you've become a Christian, don't expect a congratulations card to arrive on your doorstep the next day from the devil. If you try to do something for Christ, don't expect the devil's help in the process. He's not there to make life easy for you. The battle in heaven is fought out in your life, and as we've seen earlier in Revelation, in the church. If you don't stand, then the devil leaves you alone. That's because he's already done the damage, hasn't he? If you don't stand, he hasn't got anything to do. And that means, though we fight, but we fight knowing the result. But the fight is still real. Just because the outcome is assured, the fight is still real. So that's chapter 12. Second is chapter 13, Satan's fury over the future. Chapter 13 is a very important chapter in some ways. It's you see just how Satan is furious about what happens. And we see here what it looks like. Satan launches two offences against the church. The first is political power, and the second is false ideas or false religion. And it's symbolised as two beasts. Political powers in verses 1 to 10 are symbolised by a beast from the sea. And remember, we saw in Genesis, didn't we, and elsewhere, that for Jews, the sea symbolises confusion and fear. And in the book of Daniel, beasts represent particular countries, and there's reasons for that. We'll do Daniel sometime, we'll look at that. These beasts represent particular countries, but here what you get is all the beasts from Daniel sort of all thrown together into one beast. So it's not about one country, but generally it's about political powers and how they work. So in verse 2, the dragon, the devil, gives his power to the beast. In verse 4, he's worshipped by people. And verses 5 to 6, he speaks blasphemy against God. And in verse 7, he wars against Christians. And then verse 8, everyone worships him again. Now, the rest of the New Testament talks about the state as being more sort of a neutral thing. Christians are to obey the state as God uses it. God's appointed our governments and our police forces and our military to suppress evil. The issue here, though, in verse 7, is that the dragon is giving power to the state. In the hands of Satan, the state can be used to harm the church. So think, even in our own time, countries trying to stamp out Christianity, even here, try to suppress our freedoms of speech. And notice, too, it has a head that is fatally injured, and yet it is healed in verse 3. It's a point recently made to me about someone who works with in sort of closed countries, so to speak, obviously not close to him, is that evil political powers through history, as fast as you get rid of one, another appears. So if you think through, do a sort of a who's who of 20th century despots, and you go through them all, like Hitler, Stalin, Pol Pot, and you know, the list just goes on and on and on. As you sort of go, oh, phew, we got rid of that horrible man, Hitler, and we've still got Stalin. After Stalin, there's another one and another one. And just when you think one dies or is taken over by some other means, another one just pops up. one after another. And more recently, think about horrible dictators, who when is deposed or replaced, something just as bad or worse comes along. So it's interesting, the news at the moment in Syria, isn't it? Assad, you know, you'd be hard-pressed to find an Assad fan around, wouldn't you? He's a horrible man, undoubtedly a bad man. But the rebels are now, it's coming clearer and clearer that the rebels are committing war crimes, and one of the things they're doing is killing Christians. So you can have a despot who suppresses the people but allows the church to flourish, or one that does the same and stamps on the church. It's not a great choice, is it? And that's what the imagery here is of the injured head, the fatally injured head. As fast as you injure one, so the next one comes up, because there's a power standing behind them. So this is what the beast from the sea is all about. Not specific nations like you get in Daniel, but the general flow of history. But there's a warning here in verses 9 to 10. That's actually taken from part of the Old Testament. We're not to fight the world with the world's weapons. We're to fight evil with good and leave the rest to God. And this will mean endurance, and that will mean for some death and prison. That's the first beast. The next beast comes up in verses 11 to 18, which is false ideas. This is the second attack, and this is symbolized by this beast that comes out of the earth. And the purpose of this beast is deception. Look at verse 11. Then I saw another beast coming out of the earth. He had two horns like a lamb, but he spoke like a dragon. So he looks like Jesus in some way. There's things that he does that gives an appearance of good and Jesus-like, but he has Satan's voice. Later in Revelation, it will talk about the false prophet. False ideology in general, but especially false religion. So the second beast gets its authority from the first. It depends on the first beast, who of course is depending on the dragon. So the false ideas are only dangerous for the person holding them, but they need the state or someone else to back it up if it's really going to harm the church. So you think about Karl Marx. He was an academic sitting in the library. What harm can he do to anybody? Until in China and North Korea and other places actually enforce those ideas and kill Christians to control their state. Islam is not going to harm the church. Well, except in Saudi Arabia, where the state enforces the observance of Islam and other places like that and imprison Christians and worse. That's even true in countries with Roman Catholicism and Eastern Orthodoxy often suppress the church. In this country, multiculturalism, postmodernism, you know, the BBC or whatever, it's all pretty harmless, isn't it? It's anti-Christian, pro-Muslim, pro-gay. What harm does it do? Well, it becomes harmful when we must agree with everyone and can never say Jesus is the only way, and that's enforced by law. It's fine until government tries to put that into law, and you see that sort of thing all over Europe at the moment. Oh, we don't have the same problems as they have in Saudi or somewhere, but it's a problem. Traditional values are attacked, a new morality is put forward as the norm, and of course it does a massive amount of damage to our society over time. People who oppose at first are ridiculed, and then they're prosecuted, and ideas spread in very ordinary places. So what you have is philosophical ideas find their way into universities, people are taught them in universities, and that means they become the next generation of teachers, and it's taught in schools, and then it goes into the TV, and then it becomes mainstream, and then we all think it's normal. Then ideas become dangerous. So the second beast has powers a bit like Jesus as well, even miracles. So spiritual power doesn't necessarily mean spiritual truth. So to say, well, I saw a miracle doesn't mean that's a good thing. So beware of impressive religious displays. If it's not centered on Christ and his cross, we need to be very wary. Christians may suffer in two ways under false ideas: brute force, which we've seen earlier, or economically, which we get now in verses 16 and 17. Everyone is marked by the second beast with a number. And this is where, of course, people have a field day, isn't it? The number of the beast, 666. It's not an unfortunate birthmark, like in the film The Omen. I assume none of you have seen The Omen. I saw it when I was a student. I make a strong recommendation. Really, you've got better things to do with 2 hours in your life. It's a very bad film. on all sorts of levels. So it's not about an unfortunate birthmark on someone's head somewhere. It's not about barcodes either. Have you heard that one? Did you miss that one? A couple of people heard it. I remember being told about that when I used to go to Greenbelt when I was sort of a teenager. And what's really funny is on the back of our Bibles, we nearly always have barcodes. So we're in a lot of trouble if that's the number of the beast. So it's not about barcodes or birthmarks. But remember what we've already looked at in Revelation, and it's going to come up in the next chapter, is Christ marks his people. We're going to look at this in a moment again. So the second beast marks his. Christ marks his. The beast marks his. Everyone is marked by the beast or by Christ. What matters is the effect of this marking. You can't trade without the mark. No mark, and you can't buy or sell. We can see examples of this today. For example, in Pakistan, you can't trade in certain goods if you're a Christian. It's true elsewhere as well. Christians are barred from certain jobs or from selling things. Being marked by the beast, it doesn't mean being a literal thing, but the idea of being in agreement with his ideas, which will be different from place, time to time, country to country. Without this agreement with the beast, without this agreement with the ideology of where you are, you're going to make yourself poor. And Christians have mostly, through most of the world, through most of history, been the poor, haven't they? And many are today. Often when Christianity hits a country in a big way, after some time the economy picks up, but Christians often, for the fact that they are Christians, are opting for poverty. And you may be able to think of examples from that in our own society in a smaller way. You may be faced at work with a small temptation to compromise, but of course compare that with a huge temptation in Pakistan. I've got a choice of picking over a rubbish heap to make my living or having a job where I get a paycheck. That would be a hard choice to be a Christian, wouldn't it, in that situation? And Christians often do give in. They do take the mark, so to speak, to be in the world. And the point here, I think, of chapter 13 is that it is attractive. We feel out of sync. We feel that we're losing out by being Christians. And that's not new to Revelation, is it? We've been, as a family, been reading through Exodus, and it's interesting how the people grumble. That's an interesting theme of the church in Israel, isn't it? And sometimes New Testament is they grumble. And the thing they grumble about is, wasn't it better before we were saved? No, but it's because the things they miss out on because they're God's people. So you feel out of sync and that you're losing out. But that is the point of the beast, is deception. That's his weapon. Now the number 666, I don't think we should get bogged down with, but it is probably linked to 777. Seven is the number of completeness, so the idea that it's almost complete, it's almost perfect, but it's less than. So it's complete times three. It appears good, but it's less than. It's like the bit about he looks like a lamb but speaks like a dragon sort of idea. So Satan is he's defeated and he's furious. And in his anger, he launches these two attacks on the church. One is corrupt political power against us, and the other is to throw out false ideas, especially about religion. So it could be sort of false ideas like Marxism and some other sort of philosophies out there, or it could be a religious one. Often it all comes together. And notice the response in verse 18 is we need to call for wisdom. And the chapter sounds very much like Daniel, doesn't it? A blend of images from Daniel. And Daniel is actually rather than a book of prophecy, it's really a book of wisdom. And the application in Daniel, as it is in this chapter, is hold on. Don't give in to compromise and persecution. Don't become like them, and don't give in to the pressure they put on you that way. There are two ways we're going to give up, isn't it? So if you go around the world, often the reason why Christians give up is because you can't trade, you're going to be poor if you're a Christian, or because it's a threat to your life, your family's life, and our threat here is, oh, well, I'll just be like everyone else. They are the threats we come under. So we should expect this sort of stuff. And the third section in chapter 14 is about the future of the church. And this is the end of the particular cycle we're looking at. It's an action replay, really, that we see the church, those marked, the 144,000, do you remember them? Chapter 7, we met the 144,000. They've been marked by Christ. They have been through the seals. They've been through history. They've been through the war with the dragon. They've been attacked by the two beasts. And who is left? Well, verses 1 to 5, 144,000. The church triumphant stands despite it all. Jesus has not let one of them slip by. All he marked still stand. Despite prison and physical death, they stand before him. Now, if we remember back in chapter 7, we reminded ourselves that often Jehovah's Witnesses on the door tell us that there's 144,000 in heaven and the rest of us rough it on earth. We did remember then that heaven comes to earth in the end of Revelation, so that doesn't quite work. What you get here, so that was back in chapter 7, 144,000. Here in chapter 14, we find that they're all Jewish virgin men. So if you ever get a JW at the door and he shows you chapter 7 and says that 144,000 in heaven, everyone else in a new earth, take them to chapter 14 and ask them if they think that they're all, the 144,000 are Jewish virgin men. And they will say, no, that's symbolic. Well, perhaps the 144,000 might be as well. So we saw in chapter 7 that 144,000 is 12 times 12 times 1,000, the complete number of God's people. So 12 being the old covenant, next 12, new covenant, 1,000 lots. Why virgins? First, because verse 1, they're standing at Mount Zion. That's God's dwelling place. And this picture takes us back to Exodus, and at Mount Sinai, they were kept pure. They had to, before they met with God, they had to keep themselves pure, and one of the things they did was that those who were married abstained for a few days to show their total devotion to God. So it brings that to mind. Also, the next bit, in verse 8, and also later in the book, it talks about Babylon, and Babylon symbolizes all opposition to God. And sometimes that's religious, sometimes that's political, sometimes it's philosophical. It could be any kind of opposition. In Revelation, just gets all grouped together as Babylon. And here, Babylon is called a prostitute. So you have a contrast of Babylon, prostitute, unfaithful, and the church, Christ's bride, faithful. So elsewhere, the church is called, is described as one woman who's faithful. Here it's a church of 144,000 men who are faithful. That's the sort of contrast. So men who've not been seduced by the prostitute. So all these other men have been seduced by Babylon. These men have stayed pure. So that's what the imagery is about. It's very vivid imagery as well. The Old Testament has this idea of idolatry being linked to adultery. And idolatry is often called adultery against God. So literally what he's saying here in chapter 14 is don't get into bed with the values of this world. And that applies sexually, but not only sexually, in other ways as well. Views that we have about work, about family, about money, about everything. He's saying, don't get in with the values of this world. Stay separate. So the 144,000 is the complete number of God's people, and they've not given up and compromised with the world. But they're not the heroes of the story. The hero is Jesus, because what has to be seen here is his work. It says that they are redeemed. So the result of the Lamb buying them. They follow the Lamb, and that, of course, has lifestyle implications. They've not earned the right to be in the 144,000. And isn't it funny here that the Lamb has now become the shepherd? And then verses 6 to 13 is the church's role. We saw this the other week, didn't we, in chapter 11. Just before the end comes, it talks about the role of the church. And the same role comes out here. It's to bear witness. So verses 6 to 7 is the positive gospel call, the eternal gospel it's called here, calling the world to worship the Creator. We start our service with a call to worship. The church is a call to worship to the world. We exist because worship doesn't exist. We're to call people to worship God and to do it for eternity. And in verse 8 there's a negative side, which is announcing the fall of Babylon, the fall of those not standing with God. Babylon is the false values of this world that promises so much. And it disappoints often in this life, but it fails totally in the next. And then verses 9 to 13, the third angel makes the appeal, our appeal. Whose side are you on? Are you on the side with the beasts, in other words, the popular culture and ideas? Verses 9 to 11, you will benefit for now, but verse 10, you will drink God's wrath. Look at verse second half of verse 10 to verse 11. He will be tormented with burning sulfur in the presence of the holy angels and the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment rises forever and ever. There is no rest day or night for those who worship the beast and his image, or for anyone who receives the mark of his name. Notice here, it's not talking about devil worshippers. It's talking about those who go with the flow. There was a cheesy Christian poster I remember when I was a student that said, only dead fish go with the flow. So the idea is that Christians go against the flow of the culture. It's not talking about something really sinister. It's just talking about going with the flow of our culture. Now, I said at the beginning, is being a Christian like watching TV or fighting in a battle? Well, actually, you see, one of the dangerous places for Christians is TV. And I say, I've got a TV, I've got a TV license. That's fine, but it's more dangerous than you think, because all the ideas are just pumping at you all the time, and you just think this is normal, and it's not. And I think some of the TV that actually looks more innocuous can be more dangerous than the stuff that's obviously putting out bad ideas. It just makes you feel that things are convenient and happy for now, just going with the flow. But the future is being tormented in the presence of Christ. And it talks about the smoke of his destruction. They're chilling words, aren't they, in verse 11? The smoke of their destruction rises forever and ever. Look at verse 13. Then I heard a voice from heaven say, write, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. Yes, says the Spirit, they will rest from their labor, for their deeds will follow them. And this is the message that we're charged with. It's to proclaim God's victory and the world's defeat, and then say, you have a choice. Do you want to be a winner or a loser? The smoke of their destruction, the torment that goes up forever and ever, or eternal blessing? When you put it like that, it's quite obvious, isn't it? There's a simple choice, but people often choose badly. And we see why that already is from our previous chapter, in chapter 13. The false ideas that they've been deceived by, and short-term ease and gain. And then the end comes, and we see the fruit of the church's work in verses 14 to 20. A great NIV heading says, the harvest of the earth. At just the right time, Christ will harvest the earth. There's a harvest of wrath. He will end all opposition, a picture of destruction for those who have not responded in repentance and faith. Christ is at work. Christ's work in the past makes sense of our experience now, doesn't it? He gives us hope for the future. All is guaranteed, but we have a part to play, and that part is endure. And that's the message of Revelation. It keeps on coming up, doesn't it? Endure. Endure. Keep going. Endure because you know the victory is won, so hang on. Endure because you know the future. It may be tough now, so hang on. And for some, that will cost life and poverty. We must be willing for it to cost that for us too. I'm assuming in Chelmsford it won't. I can't promise it, though. Mission agencies nowadays mission agencies generally have pension funds for their missionaries. And why not? I have one. I guess most of you do. The rest of us have them. Why shouldn't missionaries have them? But it's an interesting contrast, because the advice they used to give to missionaries was to choose their coffin that they were going to take out with them when they used to go. Now, there's still risks in the mission field, for sure. There's still a great sacrifice in going to some parts of the world as a missionary. But what we've seen about the church in Revelation is that we're all called to that task. You are a missionary here. I don't know if you've chosen your coffin yet. Are you as confident of the future as they were? Could you say, I'm living for Christ to such an extent that actually I don't mind what it's going to cost me in money or life? Part of enduring and faithfulness and following the Lamb is telling others. Verses chapter 14, verses 6 to 13, proclaiming comes before the end. The same in chapter 11, verses 1 to 14, we tell before the end. That's the role of the church. We need to take that verse very seriously, don't we? That says, the smoke of their destruction rises forever and ever. We give people the gospel and the choice. Submit to King Jesus now, or be tormented before him then. Everyone will stand before him. And for some it's going to be a wonderful day, and others a terrible day. These picture images in Revelation are quite black and white. They're quite stark, aren't they, on these pages? And we like to, because of that, and because I almost wince at reading them, I'm just too polite, we like to soften. We don't want to put people off with talk about hell. But it exposes that we don't really want to tell. It has to happen this way, or else Christ would be insulted. So we need to think as a church, collectively, what's our aim? Why are we here? Why are we here? Why don't we just let someone else do it? How are we open and friendly to others? And how do we give the full message and never hold back, but still being accessible to people and shaped by the Bible? Of course, often churches do the opposite, don't they? They hold back the message, we don't want to offend, whilst being unwelcoming, obscure and irrelevant. And individually, the church is made up of us. The church is us, the church, but it's made up of a group of us. What will I do? What will you do personally? Are you happy with the smoke of their destruction going up forever and ever? Are you happy to compromise, to jump into bed with Babylon and be marked by the beast? It's an awkward question, isn't it? Revelation's full of sort of shuffling kind of awkward questions. Like, if you don't want others saved, are you saved? If we're telling others, it's just a matter of obedience. Being a Christian is just a matter of obedience. If your future is secured, no harm can be done to you. Think about that for a moment. If your future is assured, there's no harm that can be done to you. Even death ultimately can't harm you. For a Christian, you can say, but a death never hurt anybody. It's the worst they can do. Not to say I'm not indifferent about the matter, but there's no harm that can be done. So what do we have to fear? I suppose that's the thing I often fear when I talk to people about Jesus, is what will they think of me? Well, Jesus loves me. It doesn't matter what anyone else thinks. The power of God is in the message. It's not how good you are. We leave the results to him. And what a great message we have to offer the blessing of God. You can deliver that to other people. And what an urgent message we have because of the destruction of those who are not with God. The Christian life is in that tension, isn't it? You are safe, but you may suffer. The battle has been won, but you've just been called up. Christ has done it all, and yet you have a job to do, to call others to worship the living and the saving God. Let's pray together. The smoke of their torment rises forever and ever. There is no rest, day or night, for those who worship the beast and his image, or for anyone who receives the mark of his name. Blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. Yes, says the Spirit, they will rest from their labour, for their deeds will follow them. Lord God, we find this sobering words that your judgment is coming and it's real, and yet we've been rescued. But not just rescued from that, but rescued to something. Rescued to a glorious future, but also to a task for you now. There's a reason why you've left your church on earth. And we pray that you'd make us more and more effective in delivering this message. Not because we fear you or because we must to be accepted, but from a position of absolute security that although we're called up, the battle has already been won. Amen.